it's my pleasure to introduce our next speaker, and this is Dr. Cheryl Olson, who will give us insights into more effective grant writing. Cheryl recently moved to this area from Boston, where she was co-director of the Center for Mental Health and Media at Massachusetts General Hospital and Harvard Medical School. Prior to that, she lived in Basel, Switzerland, where she worked on global communications for Hoffmann La Roche, the pharmaceutical company. In addition to her academic work, Cheryl's an award-winning video producer and the author or ghostwriter of a half dozen books on health, two of which were New York Times bestsellers. She's also been a consultant to both nonprofit organizations and for-profit businesses around the world. A few months ago, she gave a keynote address at a major conference at the University of Vienna in Austria. This week, she was invited to present at a conference this August in Seoul, South Korea. But why should we pay attention to when she talks about grant writing? Let's start with the fact that her first grant application brought in $1.5 million. That's why the directors of nonprofit organizations listen to and benefit from what she has to say. Cheryl received her bachelor's and master's degrees from the University of Minnesota and her doctorate in public health from Harvard University. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Cheryl Olson.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Can you hear me all right?
Yes.
Good morning. It's great to be here, and thanks again to George Washington University for hosting this event. There are dozens of books and articles on the nuts and bolts of grant writing. They'll tell you how to format your budget, leave white space in your margins so reviewers can make notes on your proposal. And that's fine. And I will suggest a few of those resources at the end of my talk and a few during. But today we're going to look at some of the assumptions that people often make in nonprofits about grant writing and how those assumptions can get in the way of success. Here are five ways to improve your odds. First, use a metaphorical rifle and not a shotgun. When you look for potential funders, don't go with a scattershot approach. Target carefully. I'll go into, obviously, each of these in great detail. Value your time. I think in nonprofits, often we tend to not value it as much as we should. Wasting time costs money and opportunities. You want to look for ways to be more efficient in your grant research and grant writing. Start at the end. When you're writing a grant, don't start with the summary, the needs section, so on, that we usually start with. Start your writing at the end of the narrative and work backwards. I'll explain why. Focus on outcomes, not process, as Larry just pounded into you. Funders care much more about your results than the details of your program. And finally, don't forget to engage the funder's emotion and create a vision for them. Paint pictures with your words. First, targeting. Now, imagine you're looking for a new job. You might craft a resume and cover letter and shotgun it through Monster.com, other sites, to dozens of employers every week. And you might just change the name and address. If you're lucky, you remember to do that. And a few other details. the more, the better, right? I mean, you might say, well, I sent out 50 this week. I'm really productive. The other approach is to carefully target a few companies. Research those companies, identify their goals and needs, read up on their key people and achievements, and send a few customized, carefully targeted resumes and cover letters. And I think we can probably agree on which of those has a better chance of success in most cases is the targeted approach. I often hear very smart people say, that foundation or that company, they have a lot of money. Let's ask them for some money. Or, my friend has a cousin on the board of directors of that foundation. We can get an inside track. Not so much. It doesn't work that way. Just as your organization has a mission, your funder's organization also has a mission. You need to understand their goals and how they prefer to reach those goals. They have to be a good match for you in a number of ways. One thing to do first also is step back and think about what you need, when you need it, what it will cost. Is a grant the right way to go? Don't automatically assume that a grant is what's best. If you need say a few thousand dollars to buy a piece of equipment or to expand a program a little bit, you might want to approach an individual about funding rather than automatically write a grant. This is especially true if you could use the money soon, since you probably know a foundation or government grant can take many months or even years, especially in the case of the government, to arrive. And then consider what you want to do with the money you're asking for. Often, certain grant makers will only fund certain types of things. Few of them want to pay for operating expenses, such as your HVAC, your light bulbs. Some will fund ongoing programs if your mission closely matches theirs. But most grant makers prefer to fund new or innovative things, say an after-school program that reduces under-supervised time among middle school kids and risky behavior. They might want to expand a promising program to a new location, to a different population. But something new about it. The other thing to do is look at the size of the grants that they give, not just the average, but the large and small, so you have a sense of, is this a good match, or are they only giving out, you know, $200,000 grants, and we really, you know, only need $25,000 here, we can't justify more. Look at who they fund. Look at their past grants, not just their official guidelines. Who have they been giving to? Are all of this foundation's grants to local offices of national groups, to small community groups, to groups with certain religious or cultural ties, or to major medical centers, research groups? And where do they give? You can go to, there's a great website, GuideStar.org, that will let you look up a lot of information, including what's called the Form 990, where nonprofits have to give a lot of detail. Sometimes if you get a smaller foundation, they don't list their guidelines on the web. They might only list their guidelines buried in, deep into their 990. So that's something that obviously I don't have time to go into in detail now, but that's something you want to get familiar with. One example of the location, the John and James Knight Foundation, that was founded on newspaper money, and they only give money for community projects in cities where these brothers used to own newspapers, 26 different cities. So you really need to be sure you're not wasting your time on that. And then don't just look at the basics at the website, the brochure. Look at their publications. The Foundation Center website, foundationcenter.org, has what they call PubHub, which lets you look at their publications. You can go in and let me bring up a sample page. You can go in and search by keywords, by type of document, by area. Say if I do after-school programs, I can look those up, and I can look up by a specific funder, or say, okay, I want their annual reports, their evaluation results, their issue briefs, and you can really get a, and there's a lot that comes up when you do this, and usually they're downloadable right to your desktop for free, and you can get a lot of information about how they view things, even the way they describe a certain issue that may be different from the way you're used to describing it, but you mean the same thing, and you wouldn't know it unless you looked up that detail. Yeah, oh, I'm sorry. You want me to just leave the slide up?
No, one more back.
One more back. Okay. Sorry about that. I think I do have this on a handout as well.
It'll be up on the web tonight.
Yeah. And if you go to the foundationcenter.org, one of their pull-down menus is Gain Knowledge, and PubHub is under that. Is that okay? All right. And I think, as Larry was suggesting, don't force-fit your programs into a funder's niche. It can be tempting to just look at the request for proposals, see what funders are looking for, and try to recast your organization, your program, your research project to fit those criteria. Sometimes you can say, well, we were really interested in moving into that area, and this is a chance to start doing that. We do have the capacity. Here's an example from the Philanthropy News Digest, which is also a Foundation Center publication. The ING Run for Something Better program seeks to increase physical activity in students by childhood obesity. That's their values. They want to fight obesity. They will give a minimum of 50 grants of $2,000 each to U.S. public schools. Okay, so this U.S. public schools, that's telling me what the limitations are, that want to establish a school-based running program or expand an existing one. only grades 4 to 8, public elementary middle schools. You know, so there's a lot of limitations on there, but if you happen to fit that, and they had an FAQ which said it can't be the track team, it has to be a running program, it can't just be boys or just girls. So, you know, you really have, and that's a lot of, that's pretty narrow for just a couple $1,000s. But if you fit into that, and this was something you, or you have existing obesity reduction grants, existing school programs, you might say, yeah, this is worth it to me. I want to go through that. But you don't want to fake expertise that you don't have. You don't want to, you know, hope that you can maybe just sort of divert those funds later to your existing programs. You know, funders have even been known to take back grants. So this brings me to my second point. Your time is money. How much time will it take to research and apply for this grant, and what is the return to you and your organization? Another reason to target funders carefully is the opportunity cost. We don't always think about that. The time that you've spent applying for grants that you can't spend administering programs, networking with experts or donors, researching partnerships, all kinds of things that can make your organization stronger or more appealing to funders. You know, in most cases, it costs the same in terms of your time to apply for $2,000 or $200,000. Now, you have to justify why you would need $200,000, but think about, are you asking for too little? It can be scary to apply for a big grant. I mean, as was mentioned, my first grant that I wrote and received was for $1.5 million. That was, even in the lofty halls of Harvard, that was a little intimidating. This was about for research on how video games affect young teenagers. And it almost seemed ridiculous to ask for that much money, but it was a good match for the funder's interest and for our capabilities. And the reputation of Harvard didn't hurt, but it turned out to be a good investment of my time, even though it did take me a couple of years to get the money. Now, don't be afraid to call or email the funder. I often think, well, I'll just look it up on the web. I don't want to bother somebody. But if you can't find all the information you need about a promising funder on their website, in their publications, don't be afraid to call them up or email them and ask. You know, say, this is the type of research that we do, or this is the population that we serve. Does that fall under the scope of what you fund? You know, as long as you've got focused questions and aren't just saying, gee, do you like us? Grantmakers like talking to you because it saves them from wasting time reading through inappropriate proposals. And they get a lot of them. The other thing, you know, before I applied for my big grant, I was fairly new at writing these very elaborate government-oriented grants. I asked colleagues of mine around Mass General Hospital in different areas if they'd be willing to share some of their past successful proposals with me, because I wanted to get I had the guidelines, but I wanted to get a feel for kind of what kind of information do you want in each section, how do you want to phrase it, where might you want to use a chart or a graphic, you know, all those kinds of things that you don't just get from a set of bullet points. And this saved me time on proposal writing, but it also saved me a lot of time worrying about, well, did I get the right thing in there? Did I miss something? Reading over things a lot of times. If you don't have anyone you can ask for sample proposals, there are also books available of samples. The Foundation Center sells one, I know, that's, I think, 35 different successful proposals in full length. I guess you get a sense of, or maybe you're successful at what you're doing, but you might learn about a different style that would be appropriate to certain other types of funders that you just hadn't thought about changing. So when you come to actually writing the proposal, it can be hard to know where to start. But I think the most efficient way to go is to start at the end. And I don't mean the very end with the budget bibliography, but the end of the narrative. What will be the result of this funder's investment in you? That's where you want to start. When I've worked in the past with grant seekers on evaluation plans, I often find they have trouble explaining exactly what they're trying to do. I mean, they basically know, but they're not used to putting it in clear and measurable terms. For example, one group wanted funding for anti-smoking classes for young teens. And when I asked them, well, what's your goal? They said, well, we want to teach about 60 students. And a funder doesn't care about that. They care about what will happen if you are successful. What are these classes for? I mean, obviously, they do want metrics in terms of, you know, about how many people are being helped and who are they. But you have to start from what are you trying to accomplish. You know, In this case, you know, I mean, even with anti-smoking, are you trying to prevent experimentation? Are you trying to prevent people from becoming regular smokers? You know, there's a lot of the more detailed you can be, the better, because that will help you measure it better, if you really know what you're going for. And this sort of thing leads, if start at the end, leads you naturally through a series of logical questions that you can ask yourself and your colleagues. First, I mean, what evidence do I have that this approach could work? What, you know, if I want to teach classes, is there evidence that classes of this type, this length, this orientation could conceivably create the result that I'm promising, that I'm going for? With preteens and smoking, are there studies showing that a similar approach worked with older teens or adults or worked in another setting or worked with other kinds of risk-taking behaviors that teens have? And, you know, so kind of combining the new part with what has worked in the past. And the funder will want to know who specifically you are targeting with this program and why them. Why do they need this? Have preteen smoking rates increased recently in your area, perhaps, or have they not declined as much as they have in some other states? Or is this a group that you know demographically is at high risk in terms of previous research? You need to justify, you know, why them, and, you know, how do I know that they need it? And then, obviously, why you? What makes our organization qualified to do this? What track record do we have? What special skills do we have? Maybe we have existing access to this target population or trust built up with that population. And we're kind of naturally doing expansion into other health topics. Make your case that it should be you. Another way to look at this is to focus on outcomes, not process. I think you'll leave here chanting that as you go to your cars. This is increasingly what funders want to know about. 20 years ago, you didn't hear this maybe quite so much. Now, evaluation outcomes is just, every funder wants to know, what's the bang for my buck? Now, it is important to document your process, what you plan to do to reach your goals, because that speaks to your credibility, to the feasibility. You know, can you feasibly complete your organization, your resources, your connections? Can you complete the needed tasks and do it on a certain timeline, within a certain budget? Providing a timeline chart is good too, because that speaks to your credibility, but it all has to be leading up to what's going to happen here. Most of all, funders want to know what results their money will buy, what their investment in your organization will do, how that investment will help move their mission forward. So you need to think about, what evidence can we provide that our program works? For example, if you want to prevent preteens from becoming established smokers, how can you show that helped? You know, first, you can look at what measures other programs have used. I know evaluation and research can be pretty daunting. I know when I was doing my research on video game effects, one of the areas of concern was aggression, attitudes and behaviors. And I found the Centers for Disease Control had a free compendium of scales for measuring aggression and violence on the web that I could get a hold of, and I could see what the how well those worked in the past and so on, and cite the other research. And that saved me some time that I could then devote to things that didn't have existing questions. So, look around and see how you can save yourself time. What have others used? What can you cite? And then, what can I afford? I mean, you don't want to have a project where the evaluation costs three times what the actual intervention cost. If the results you want might not show up for months or years, maybe you want kids to not be smoking 5 years from now. How can you show that? I mean, when funders understand this, then some short-term pre-post measures might be okay. For example, you could cite evidence that changes in perceptions about how normal smoking is, your normative situation for smoking. Maybe changes in that have been shown to correlate with reduced smoking, or changes in beliefs that smoking affects sports performance or makes you less attractive, attitudes, beliefs, all those might be correlated with lower smoking rates among older teens. So look for, in the medical area, you call it surrogate endpoints. What can you show? You just want to show that you've thought through it logically and make a case. Now, even if your goal is to help a particular group of kids, funders like to see the larger implications. Could your results provide evidence, for example, that a certain style of instruction keeps kids more engaged and they're more likely to show up and not skip your classes? How could other groups learn from that and maybe help a larger group of kids do better than just your immediate group that you're helping? Sometimes your project may not be that useful in itself, but will move you or your field closer to an important goal. an example from one of my projects, and I have as a handout a copy of the letter proposal we wrote to that funder. There's a shortage of child psychiatrists, and pediatricians see a lot of kids with mental health problems. They're often the only ones who are in a position to spot them. And we want to train pediatricians how to diagnose mental health problems, treat kids appropriately in certain cases, and also know when they were in over their head when they should refer. And that all had to be done in the context of pediatricians are extremely busy. Often they don't believe that they possibly have time to do this. So we wanted to, we got a $25,000 grant to do a proof of concept video and study. We wanted to see, you know, could pediatricians come to believe that they could deal with these problems, that they were interested in dealing with these problems, and in particular, could this be done through video-based instruction? That's the cost-effective way to reach a large number of people. So that was our goal in that case. And Larry talked about painting the picture. You look at this photo of cigarette butts, it kind of hits you in the gut a little bit. It makes you go, ooh. It makes you feel something, you know, not pleasant in this case, but it does make you feel. And I'm showing this because to make your proposal stand out, to keep the funder reading through to the end, and wanting to know more about you, you need to engage them emotionally. You need to paint a picture with your words. Now, let's say I'm seeking support for a program to train teachers about teenage depression. This actually was the topic of my doctoral dissertation. I want the teachers to notice changes in students that might be signs of depression or some other problem, not to turn them into psychologists, but say, this kid is changing, this kind of thing. It could be something that the school psychologist should look at, or other, you know, other professional if you don't have one. And you want the teachers to refer students for assessment and not just ignore it. Now, I can quote statistics about how common teen depression is, and I should do that, but I also can say, look, in a typical classroom, at least one child is suffering from a serious depression right now, or they will before the school year is over. And if a teacher knows the signs and can refer that child for assessment, it can protect him from academic and social disaster at a time in his life that's just critical to these things. You could keep a child from being derailed from a bright future if the teacher can just be paying attention and picking up signs. And that's you know, painting a picture for it. Also, you want to help funders understand and to feel something about how your existing programs, your existing research, has improved people's lives. For example, you might quote a mom who couldn't find a job to support her son and how her life has changed because your program gave her affordable, high-quality childcare that started very early so she could make it to work. A funder wants to spread success. They'd like to see that you're already being successful, already doing good things for somebody. Now, Larry mentioned the idea of choosing the right type of media. Different media conveys different types of information and stories. Video can be great, for example, if you want to show what a program looks like. You want them to see what this setup is like. Want people to see, here's how this technique works. Here's how we go about teaching this in the classroom. And it can be good for that. But that also can limit you. If audio is great for conveying emotions. There's a website that actually our center did that was mostly Larry's work. You can see it at artparenting.org. ART, it stands for Assisted Reproductive Technologies, artparenting.org. And that was a video-based project where he went out and got stories from a bunch of parents and kids who'd been in situations where they built their families through some kind of assisted reproduction, or with some of the older kids, even with sperm donation, because that's the best model. This was based on a grant from a family that had twins this way, and they wanted other people to understand what this was like, that this was a normal way of building families, and to know something about the psychological issues that come with raising a kid from that situation, you know, normal psychological issues to expect. And the great thing about audio, if you go to that site and listen, is that if you are going to watch this person talk, you'd be sitting there thinking, you know, something about her hairstyle her clothes. And eventually you would get really tired of listening to her. And if it's audio, you can listen much, much longer. And you can think about what she's saying. You can think about the emotion. And it just can work very much better. Sometimes you want audio and a set of photographs. Also, if you're going to distribute this through the internet, you know, some people still have the slow connections. And you might want the audio and the photos would reach a lot more people more easily. So this, you know, these are things to think about. This is a whole other talk or workshop in itself, but different media are useful for different things. And do consider the use of audio because that's emotional and it's relatively inexpensive. So I can't teach you all you need to know, no one can, about grant writing in 40 minutes, but I hope this will get you thinking and talking with your colleagues and get you started painting some beautiful pictures with your words. Thank you. I tried to leave a lot of time for questions and examples, so I would welcome, you know, if you have a particular problem you're trying to work through or define or something you're trying to think about how to evaluate, please speak up. Yes?
I have a question more about the evidence part. Do evaluations from the people who've been through the program or whatever you're trying to do count better than statistical, general, broad, national research?
So the question is, what kind you want to look at, local data or broad national research? I think it depends on the funder. This is where looking at the funder's past report. It's often they will do a report of lessons learned from things they funded previously, or other publications they have, issue briefs. You might be able to get a sense for what kind of evidence they like. I think ideally you'll want to do both. You'll want to look at, here's the national trend for this issue. This is a huge problem. Locally, here's how it plays out in our community and with this particular population. And we have, you know, maybe our organization has past experience changing that population, doing other things with that population, so we feel confident that we could bring in this issue and make a change.
Is it more the third party research versus, you know, kind of our evaluations that people fill out after they've gone through the program? Does that count less or more? Or
I think it's a judgment call, and I one of the things that I worry a little bit about is it's very easy to have a class and say, fill out whether you liked it or not. And that really is pretty meaningless to most funders because liking is not the issue. That's where you may have to work with someone who is an expert in behavior change or evaluation, or maybe someone in your organization to say, well, what makes sense here? And a single class is not likely to change a person very much, but you could say, well, in conjunction with this larger effort going on, changes in society, in this class, what we want to do is move people along the continuum from not thinking this applied to them to thinking this does apply to them, or not believing that they could address this or do something. Say it's something for parents on getting kids to not use drugs. Often parents believe they don't have influence, that kids do not listen to them. And there's a lot of research to show that kids do listen, and their values generally are the same as their parents. So if you can even say, okay, the goal of this presentation, ultimately, we're going to maybe ask for a show of hands or talk to people about who thinks they can, you know, what do you think your kid listens to? Tell me an example. And then ask them to fill out at the end something about what, you know, what are you going to do after this talk? What are you going to do? What are you going to say to your child? You might get a lot of interesting little anecdotal things about, here are, in five cases, here are examples of what parents said they were going to go and do in the next week with their kids. And something like that, a sense that this has driven them to action, even though, you know, on the NIH, you know, scale of grants, that would be piddly. For a funder, for a community group, they may think, yeah, these people have the right action orientation. They are looking at doing something, and they've demonstrated to me by the way they go about it. And you want to say in your proposal, here is how, you know, here are, you know, obviously we can't, you know, we have to make the evaluation appropriate to the size of the program. Here are some ways we're going to go about this to ensure that we are focusing on changing behavior. Yes?
You talked about the importance of targeting your work well and working efficiently. Mm-hmm. What do you recommend as sources to do your identification process very quickly and efficiently?
Right, the question is about how to identify sources of funders efficiently. The Foundation Center is a great resource for that. That's where I went with some of the grants that I looked for. What's nice is they have some things that are free, but also you can pay, say, by a one-time, one-month access for $20 to all of their online databases. And you can go, then you can, from your office, working with your colleagues, search by area, by geography, by all kinds of things, and turn up a whole lot of names. I think, you know, the one-month use of that, I think it's a great investment. You can also go to the library. They have these printed directories. And I believe there is a Foundation Center branch in D.C., a physical office, where you can go. Oh, right out here? Oh, okay. Where is it located exactly?
Building right here.
Oh, here at George Washington University here. Oh, okay. Well, please avail yourselves of that. Sometimes if you go to the physical library, they'll let you use their CD-ROMs and look up things for free, too. And on their website, on the handout that I have, they do have some free little self-teaching courses on grant writing, and they also have what they call webinars, where you can sign up for one. They have, I think, every 3 weeks or so, they'll have a scheduled webinar where you can sign up for free and listen to someone present this live as they go. And they also have some in-person classes. But there's, depending on where you see your need and how you learn and what your budget is and your time, you could go at a whole lot of different levels. And there are some pretty good books out there, too. Oh, I'm sorry. In terms of...
My question isn't, how do I learn about grants? Mm-hmm. My question is, how do I find just the right foundation to write a grant?
Well, that's...
FoundationCenter.org, we all know about them. They're the most obvious. Mm-hmm. But are there other sources that are less obvious, given that I would much rather devote my time to writing the grant than trying to figure out which grants to write?
Yeah, that's understandable. There are often family foundations that are somewhat obscure, and that's where guides. Larry, maybe you can speak to this too, because you've done. Do you have anything to say about that?
Yeah, I mean, GuideStar has some information you can do. I would first start in the community, because a lot of money is available through what are called donor-directed funds, which are small alternatives. And trust officers and banks have information on that. Attorneys who do wills, trusts, and estates have information on that. And if you, without directly soliciting these people, say, this is what we're doing, is there anyone you're working with where it fits into what they're looking for? I also would encourage you to reverse your priorities and spend more time trying to find the right match than writing grant proposals. Because you're going to waste a lot of time because you feel more comfortable writing.
Sure, but you still want that time to be spent efficiently.
Yeah, but maybe you should be writing 2 grant proposals, not 10. That's the wrong metric.
There's a community foundation executive director in the, I don't know, Karen, do you have anything to say about community foundations as a resource for this sort of thing?
The community foundations in the area are a great resource to approach, particularly for the donor advised funds, as Dr. Kuttner was talking about. We're a small community foundation serving Loudoun and Bacare in development mode, but we do give out about 95% of our money through donor advised funds, which do not have an application process. But community foundations will often take information. For example, we have a nonprofit survey you can fill out, which tells us very much about what your organization is doing, what money would help you. There's a whole process. Mm-hmm. And we pass that information along to donor advisors. So while you don't have a direct, I'm going to write exactly to the donor advisor group, you may have a way to get your need up in front of your community, whichever one you're closest to. That's kind of
Depending on your field, I'm sorry, did you have anything else to say about that?
No, I was just going to say that certainly is a way to find out. We may not disclose which donor advisors, because obviously they're working with us because they may not want to be directly approached, but there is still a way to get your ideas in front of those folks.
The other thing you can do is try to get on a lot of e-newsletter lists. I subscribe to the Philanthropy News Digest weekly e-newsletter from the Foundation Center. The Department of Education has a couple of, and I have this on the handout, a couple of listservs you can get on that where they'll send you things that relate to requests for proposals. And again, those requests may or may not be exactly what you're looking for, but that funder may be someone you want to keep an eye on for something else. It can just open you up to... Or you might contact the funder and say, we're in this field too. Do you have, we're not in your geographic area. Do you know of a group that funds in our geographic area? Because they network. It's not that big of a stretch. And then, of course, there's the big government, grants.gov and the big government ones too. And it's hard to speak about this in a way to a group because there's such a wide range of where people might be going after funds and such a wide range in size. It is, it's a tough hunt. Other questions? Yes.
I was just going to add a comment to a previous question. Associated
Association of Fundraising Professionals. If you go in your local chapter, a lot of times you have access to their national website for resources. And one thing that I try to do is structure my time so that 5 hours out of the day I'm researching, and maybe 5 hours out of the day I'm writing. So you know how much time you're spending researching versus writing. And you know, in the perfect world, that would be a great thing to do, but I understand you have distractions.
Right. So,
there are resources out there.
Yes.
The other thing for local area, which I did when I first came in here in 2003 to get a feel for who's here, the Melissa Data website is another
okay.
one you can go to.
Melissa Data. What's the URL?
Just Google Melissa Data, and you will get it. Will pop right up. And
okay.
when you come on there, there is a nonprofit area, and you have an opportunity to go in. And by zip code, you can bring up every single nonprofit in that zip code. You can quickly go down and see assets and gifts for the last year they filed in 990, and you immediately see who the large funders are or where the large amount of traffic is coming from. Mm-hmm. You can join, you can purchase, and then you have unlimited access, or you can just mm-hmm. go in and get a certain amount of free information. Take you maybe a week and a half to pull up all the information for the area. Get your zip codes by calling the post office and finding out what are all the zip codes for Loudoun, what are all the zip codes for interested, and you will build your own immediate use information piece of who's funding what. And then, as I suggested, you go into GuideStar and look at the 990s and you find out a lot more. But that's an excellent starting point if you're looking locally.
So what does Melissa Data charge if you were to go in on a one-time basis, roughly?
Nothing.
Nothing? Oh,
absolutely nothing. You can go in and use it, and they'll tell you, you know, maybe 30, 40 times. They'll say, okay, you're done for today.
Oh, I see. They put a cap on you. Okay.
Exactly. But if you have particular zip codes you're interested in right off the bat, you can do that. But, you know, they will share between counties. So.
Well, so this obviously shows the benefit of a group like this meeting. There's a terrific amount of knowledge just in this room. Yeah. Anyone else have a particular question?
Can you talk a bit about the thing of the larger presentations?
Yeah.
The use of metrics for evaluation, getting the right metrics. Thinking of the driving thing out in California that you consulted on.
Mm. Right. Larry's mentioning a project that I did in California called the Tobacco Free Challenge, which was a very interesting little project to reach out to a target audience that was really underserved and had a high smoking rate, which was teenagers who went to dirt track racing around, you know, rural areas of California. And they started a program where they had to get winning drivers for it to work, but they got a couple of good drivers, including a young teenage girl driver. And what we did to evaluate the results of that, we went out to the tracks. I mean, I even had actually our son, who was, I think, 10 at the time, helping me hand out surveys around the track and trying to look at some of these issues in terms of beliefs and attitudes. One thing I caution you about when doing evaluations is focusing too much on changes in knowledge. I mean, sometimes there are facts that people need to know, or they need to know, you know, sets of skills, but very often the reason you want them to know the facts is so they will do something, or so you'll change their attitude, such as with the pediatricians. The pediatricians have to believe that they have time to deal with certain mental health problems and to feel it's part of their job before they'll even consider looking at any of the information I have about how to diagnose. So you really have to think about what are the levels of change that someone might need to go through. And usually you can find research on your particular topic that might support that. But think beyond the typical, okay, we want them to be aware or we want them to know this fact, because that almost always is really a way station along the line to what you really want to accomplish. Anyone else have a question, or are you anxious to get on to the coffee? I know we only have about one more minute. Yes.
Well, I'll go ahead and ask you then. What did you find out in your research about violence?
The video game. My video game violence research. Well, there's a whole book on that, actually, Larry and I did together called Grand Theft Childhood. That's actually, you can read it at grandtheftchildhood.com. We have excerpts from it and some handouts. But I started out very concerned about games like Grand Theft Auto, and I'd read what everyone else read about is, oh my lord, you can, you know, kill prostitutes and get your money back. You can do these horrible, violent splatter. And I ended up, especially after realizing, based on our data, that the typical 13-year-old boy is playing at least one mature-rated video game in a typical week. I mean, the typical player of these violent games is your local middle school soccer team. I mean, it's a normative behavior for kids today, and we know that youth violence has not gone up. It's gone down, in fact, in the last 10 years, which is not saying video games reduced violence. But we did look at things like bullying, which seemed a lot more realistic, and we did find a correlation between heavy play, playing where most of the games you play are violent, and you're playing them for more hours than the typical kid per week. That was correlated with a higher risk of physical fighting or bullying others, especially for girls, because playing violent games is less normative for girls. With boys, in fact, we found that those who didn't play any games at all had a higher rate of problems, but that was such a small group we couldn't really understand. I mean, not that every kid who doesn't play video games has something wrong with them, but it might be that since boys tend to socialize around gameplay, that it was a sign of maybe poor social skills for some of these boys. And I'm going to scratch the surface here. I do have on my website, ckolson.com, I just got that site up 2 days ago, I do have a list of my publications, including, I think, full text of most of the publications out of that research, which you can download if you really want to pursue this. But this is a topic everyone has an opinion about, which is why I've gone and spoken in a lot of different areas around the world about it. The best advice I give to parents is to get the game console and the computer out of the kids' bedroom, because we know that they tend to, our research suggested that kids are playing more hours, playing more games with violent content if they have it in their room. And if it's out of there, you can walk by and see what's happening now and then. And if you can't do that for whatever reason, take away the controls or the cell phone, everything at night, put them in your room, or use the parental controls. There's a lot of controls built into the systems nowadays, because kids don't have good self-control. That's because they're kids, you know. And you can't say, oh, well, now stop at 10 o'clock and go to sleep. And we know, you know, you probably can't do that yourself. I try not to have a TV in my bedroom, but what you want to make sure to do is to model moderation, and don't think that just because it's called a game that's for kids, they're just like movies or books nowadays. There's a wide range of content, and parents often are still shocked if they haven't been involved in video games since Pong or Space Invaders. It's a full-fledged medium now with everything from soup to nuts. So I'd be happy to chat afterwards if you want about video games a little bit more. Thank you so much. I think I've used up my time. Thank you.